For Blind Cool Tech, I'm Steve Bauer, and this podcast will let you hear the entire issue of Playback Magazine for March 2006. This podcast is being made available with permission from Ed Potter. And of course, if you are not a subscriber to Playback Magazine and you like what you hear, you're encouraged to subscribe. All that information will be included in the podcast.
He's got a hot pot of Java,
all steaming and black.
He's got his braille notes organized,
all in a stack.
He's got his tape recorder cured to the start of the track. And now he's sitting down to do another playback. Another playback magazine.
Well, greetings, everybody, and welcome to Playback, edition number 160 for March 2006. And you know, we're beginning this issue later than I think we've begun it in years. It's about a quarter to 11. It's kind of sunny here, and I left the side door open so you could hear the sound of those wonderful bird songs from birds who who believe they're going to live forever. Well, join the club. Playback is hosted, as you well know, by Ed Potter at 1308 Evergreen Avenue, Goldsboro, G-O-L-D-S-B-O-R-O, North Carolina, 27530. Phone 919-736-0939. Or for orders or phone reports, if you don't have all-you-can-eat long distance, it's 888-217-2312. Recording date is on Wednesday the 15th, and I expect we'll have it all wrapped up and in the mail by Friday or Saturday. By the way, Playback subscription prices are $21 for the calendar year and $12 if you want the underground sent to you automatically. There are other ways to get the underground, and maybe we should review them now. I notice that my old senior citizen PMD 220 is kind of groaning at us all this morning. You may buy individual undergrounds if you want them at $2 each, or if you send a good quality C90 tape with a return mailer, the cost is just a dollar. A couple of you sent tapes and envelopes but forgot to include the dollar this last time. We didn't keep your undergrounds away from you. But try to remember that next time. If you sent something in that appeared on the underground, only thing we'll need will be a tape and a mailer. You can keep your buck. Strictly personal, well, we had a mild winter here. No snow, no ice, no heavy winds. And our lives have pretty much been uneventful. And at our stage in life, Miss Sue and I like to say boring is best. I have a birthday next Friday, which levitates me to the 74th year and outside of a senior moment once in a while. I'm really in very good health, as I have been for decades, and I'm grateful for that. As the weather warms, Miss Sue is back digging and delving in her garden, and it's hard to believe that within 3 months we're going to be munching those fresh blueberries again for breakfast. One kind of very personal matter I decided to share with you. I had a false medical alarm in January, which required a colonoscopy, a real thrill. Well, the problem is that you don't know until the doctor looks whether it's going to be a life-changing event or nothing at all. And fortunately for me, it was nothing at all. But what it did do is it focused my attention on what in the world to do if we have to send refunds. I hadn't really thought about it very much, but I did at that time. And I really hadn't considered what a complex piece of work would be involved. Luckily, it isn't necessary, and hopefully it won't be necessary. But folks, when you reach my age of accumulated years, you have to face directly the possibility that health matters can change abruptly. We hope they won't, and don't expect them to, but anyway, I was surprised to conclude that while refunds would be sent, it could indeed take weeks or in some cases months, depending on what's going on here. But I'm glad that this totally false scare made me focus some attention on the process of refunding. And if it does happen, you will get your bucks back, but it may take a while. Finally, Raleigh Hudson called to report the sudden death of Playback member and contributor Dick Chrisman of Arizona. Now, we'll all miss Dick because he's sent reports and you know who he is, and we do send condolences to his family. The format for this particular Playback issue is going to be quite different from what you're used to hearing. One reason is that I got a total of 5 minutes worth of content from you guys out there. Let's hope that's an anomaly and not an omen. But there are two things I've been really wanting to do in Playback and the Underground for this issue, so it'll keep it from screeching to a halt, and we'll just have to see what happens next issue. So let's see what's going to happen in issue number 160. First of all, are going to be the contents for Underground number 92, and second will be an extensive interview with Michael Moody, who is Deputy Director of the National Library Service for the Blind, and he's going to talk with us for over an hour about the conversion from cassettes to the flashcard digital talking book system. Michael is a very open and articulate person who gave clear and unevasive, detailed answers to my questions. This interview will continue for several minutes as well on track two. And for this issue only, we're going to give our bar girl a rest in track number two, and then we'll have a few items that I've accumulated for products, resources, and trends. We won't get them all in, but we'll share some of them with you. After that, I'll share with you a talk I had with a guy named Stephen Guerra, who's accessible specialist at Independent Living Aids, about a device called the Milestone 311. It's a credit card-sized voice and MP3 recorder that's an import from Switzerland and totally accessible. It talks, and you'll be able to do everything it can do. Following that, we're going to have a couple of short minis from Tim Hendel and Roger Smith. And this issue only, Joy Bubbles Telefile, is going to appear in the Underground. Then we'll have Classified and a very, very brief Potter's Hustles. So let's move on and see if we can get everything in this time on Playback number 160, and we'll begin with the contents for Underground number 92 to accompany this particular issue. The first thing we're going to have is going to be an extensive interview with blind broadcaster Ed Walker. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. It's all together on track number one and extends over into track number two. Following Ed Walker's interview on track number two, you're going to hear something called Garbage Scan. It's a wonderfully funny piece written and read by Dave Barry, sent to us by Don Hilkema. Band number three, Sending Out New Signals, Radio Catches Up from Washington Post, a piece sent to us by Charles Beeble. And on number four of that band is Telefile with Joy Bubbles. Number five, Plus Tech Text-to-Speech Reader. And number six, Taming the Tangled Web of Chords from USA Today, sent along by Charles Beeble. So, papers falling all over the place here. Let's see if we can move on to get Playback number 160 going. I've never met nor talked with Michael Moody, but after our rather extensive talk, I can see why he is where he is. The guy has any detail you want to know right at his fingertips, and he's willing to take whatever time it takes to get the job done, as you will see in our over an hour interview. I was impressed with the guy and expect to talk with him again when we're a little bit closer to full implementation of the system. There were only a few little things that he couldn't give particulars about because of pending patents, but I think that after you listen to Michael, you'll be having most of your answers to the questions that you wanted. I started right away at the beginning by asking what might be seen as a kind of a throwaway question, but I know that many of you wonder it, and that is, why are we discarding the cassette anyway? It's simple, it's cheap, it's easy to use, and we like it.
Because it won't be around much longer, and if we don't move, this horse is going to die under us. So we've got to get off it. Best projections are 2012, the old worldwide cassette industry is on its last legs. We've got trends that go out, you know, from the last 5 to 10 years on out to 2012, and so we really want to be well on our way by then. And so it's just a matter of we have to move. But also, you know, even if we didn't have to move, the advantages of digital are so great that it really is it's very compelling anyway. And you know, obviously the sound quality is going to be vastly better than it is on 15/16 four track
right
cassette, and the capabilities of what you can do in digital are, you know, just wonderful. And For linear playback, you're right. Cassette works very well, and it really has been a tremendous, tremendous medium for us for 30 years. But we find that some of our older folks never quite figure out the four-track business. We get comments back that you're only sending me half the book, and because they don't figure out how to use the side selector switch. So the new format is going to be simpler for older people to use. It's going to be tremendously robust. You won't have, you know, stretch tape or snaggle tape, and so so there's lots and lots of reasons why to move, and all of them are coming together at the right time.
Michael, how long have you guys been doing digital mastering of your books?
Since 2002, and we started in 2002. I remember correctly, it was 10% of the titles had to be done in digital form that year, 50% in 3, 100% in 4, and then in 04. And
so since then, you've all been all digital?
Yes, all digital. And actually, you know, we did a lot more than 10% the first year, and much more than 50% the next year. Once they started down that track, everybody just jumped on it and did it.
Yeah. Well, now, the next question is going to be a rather broad one, so people wonder, and let me ask it to you. Can you talk us through some of the formats you looked at and turned away from, and why?
Sure. The first one, the most obvious one, is CD-ROM. And, you know, that's what most of the rest of the world who's in digital has gone to, and there's been a lot of pressure on us to do so. And we actually had discussions with people from the Royal National Institute for the Blind in 1986. They came over here with a prototype CD player, and they were really ready to go. And but they were a bit ahead of their time. There were some, I guess, the cost issues and the complexity of the machines and stuff that just weren't quite right. And so it kind of died then, and it wasn't until the mid-90s that it picked up again, and the DAISY Consortium started its work and got their first standards together at the end of the 90s and started producing a lot of books. And so we watched this whole process, and we said, okay, CD is an option, but looking at our program, it's a lending program, and it's a distributed program. That is, this will be a long, complex, logical thing, but hopefully it'll become clear in the end.
Yeah.
We produce centrally, but distribute, you know, on a state basis, so that there's 134 libraries around the country. So then start with that assumption, and then we say, okay, CDs are you know, low cost, and they can, you know, render very nice audio quality and so forth. But what's going to happen in the lending process? Okay, so we're going to make, if we follow our first model, our current model, which is mass production of books, put them on shelves in libraries, and then the libraries circulate them over and over and over again. That works well with cassettes. It worked okay with discs, but if you get somebody who's kind of rough on the disc, everybody down the road suffers. And so one of our original libraries said, when we were discussing CD-ROM, he says, I don't want to go back to discs again. I'm going to have the same problem I have with the other. That John Smith got this book before George did, and John screwed it up, and everybody down the road is suffering. So anyway, robustness of the medium, not good. In terms of handling, you really got to be careful, and you know, a lot of people aren't, and so people downstream would suffer. Second thing is, the machine itself is, you know, CD-based machine is electromechanical. We have 700,000 cassette players in the field. They're all electromechanical, and we run day and night to keep those things repaired. We repair about 25% of them every year. So that 30,000 machines repaired every year, done mostly by volunteers. It takes a lot of our work to keep the volunteers in, you know, in parts, in training, and, you know, manage that whole thing. And there's a lot of effort and cost that goes into that. Even though the labor is free, there's a lot of money in spare parts and a lot of our time in maintaining it. So we said, next generation machine, is it possible that we can avoid having an electromechanical device? It's not a problem if you're the kind of agency that sells machines to people or says you go buy your own, because then the person who gets it, you know, if they break the machine, it's on, you know, it's on their head. Mm-hmm. But for us, we own them, we're responsible for them, and we got to live with them. So we said, can we avoid electromechanical devices? Can we avoid easily damaged media? Both of those are big problems with CDs, and we said, okay, let us see if we can avoid CDs. What are the other options? So we put it in the, on the side and said, we know this will technically work, and cost-wise it will work, but for the reasons I just explained to you, it's not desirable for NLS.
There is another question about that. You know, the companies began to build these machines and sell them. Do you feel that they were trying to anticipate where you were going and be there before you got there?
In a certain sense, they did. But in a certain sense, there are other agencies around the world that had different missions and different needs, and they decided that the CDs would work for them, and so they started. And you know, I think they did the right thing, like Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic. For their population, where you got, you know, relatively technically savvy people who own their own machines, and for whom this digital medium is an enormous, enormous advantage, they did exactly the right thing to jump on it and go. For us, where we're, you know, many, many more people are just reading linearly, the cassette works very nicely, and for the reasons I mentioned, CD isn't good for us, we chose to wait a while longer.
Do you think that had they known what you were going to do, that they might have, this is speculation, you may not want to answer it, but if they had known where you were going, that they might have wanted to wait and see if they could license your technology?
No, I don't think so. I think they needed to move when they did, and the Royal National Institute for the Blind in the UK had to move because their Clark and Smith technology was dying, and RFB and D really had to move because of technical pressures from their patrons, and they did the right thing. CNIB, Canadian National Institute for the Blind, has started moving into CD. I'm going to guess that, you know, they will eventually follow us simply because of you know, a lot of advantages that they'll find, but they're sort of getting their feet wet, but they're not, you know, they're not fully changed over. They don't have machines for everybody and so forth. So, but anyway, it's a tough thing, and every agency has to make its choice.
Yeah, sure they do.
And we said, okay, CD was one. Second one was magnetic hard drive systems, like, you know, iPods and things like that. Mm-hmm. And really, basically, same issue as electromechanical device concerns. These things are going to break, and they're just not going to be robust enough. We also said, what about just using the internet and not having any physical medium? And we think that eventually, you know, most of our books are going to go to patrons that way, but because of, you know, just the technological savvy needed these days to set up a system, the costs of having, you know, an internet service provider and all that stuff, it just would put a lot of our people out of it. We have to have a physical medium delivered by the U.S. Postal Service. Mm-hmm. Free matter for the blind is hard to argue with. So we need a physical medium, and that's going to get to everybody in the country, because the U.S. mail will get to anybody anywhere in this country if at no cost to us. You can't argue with that. So we said physical medium, USPS delivery, what's the best physical medium? And, you know, we looked around and said, and you'll probably get to questions on this later, but flash memory was our choice. And but when we made that decision, or when we decided to hold off on CD and wait for flash, it was a calculated decision made based on, you know, the information we had at the time, which was CD's not desirable, but we could live with it if we had to. Mm-hmm. Flash looks like it meets all our needs, but it's too expensive. When is its cost going to be mm-hmm. down in the range what we want? And we had, you know, plotted trend analysis since late 90s, early 2000, and we said it looked like around 2007, 2008, we're going to be in the ballpark, and Actually, the costs have fallen faster than we had projected, and so it's looking very good.
Michael, you may not know this exactly, but what percentage of your readership is, say, over 60?
About 60%. It's a sort of 60-60 rule.
So the net would not have been a good choice, would it?
No, not really.
I mean, if people can't tell that they have a four-track tape, getting on the net is...
That's exactly right.
Right.
It's technological issues, economical and technological issues, just the savvy you need to do it. Eventually you could design a system, and we think this is possible, and actually, there's some work being done in other areas to make a really simple, foolproof system that could be used by anybody, but it's a long ways away,
And of course it would anchor people to a spot, wouldn't
it?
Yeah.
Or, generally.
Unless they were going to download it to a
player and carry it away, but, yep, you got it.
Well, now tell us a little bit about this. Do you call it a flash cartridge?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
I thought maybe you might.
Yep.
Can you give us a sense of its measurements and what it would look like if we were feeling one of them?
Right. I can tell you a certain amount, but I can't tell you others because this is going to be, there'll be patents on this from the firm that's designing it, and so I can't tell you all of the
neat
features. Yeah.
Sure.
But basically, it's a little smaller than a cassette. So, if you just think of a cassette size, that's you're right in the ballpark. And you say, "Wow, that's large." And we say that's true, and that's deliberate. We could make the brains of this, the flash memory chip inside, will fit inside a little card the size of a postage stamp, and not a heck of a lot thicker. A lot of these digital flash memory cartridges for digital cameras are about the size of a postage stamp.
Yeah.
And they have as much brains as ours will have, but we obviously can't be sending out books to people on something that size for two reasons. One is they're going to get lost. You sneeze and your book is gone. And second, they're not going to be able to be labeled in a way that a blind or visually impaired person can read it. So having something about the size of a cassette, you won't have the sprocket holes in there, so you've got a lot more real estate to work with. We can have very large print information on there for people with visual impairment. We can have a Braille label with a lot of information on it. And then the cartridge is big enough to hold in for people with limited dexterity, easy to handle.
Yeah.
It can only be put in one way. You can't put it in upside down or backwards. It will have a USB connector on it, the USB connectors are very, very widespread in computer and other technologies these days, and so it's a low cost, widely used, and very robust connector. The cartridge will just slip into the player, kind of like a card goes into an ATM machine, and real easy to put in and get out.
Now, how much can you get on one of these cards?
Well, it depends on the size of the chip that you put in it. We are going to begin with 256 megabytes of flash memory. That will hold a book about 24 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be what?
Is that in an MP3 type format? Or
well, it actually will be in something more advanced than MP3.
It's a proprietary format.
No,
for you guys,
is it? It's not really proprietary. It is proprietary, but not to us.
Yeah.
It's a codec, and codec stands for coding and decoding. It's a compression system or codec called AMR Wideband Plus, and it comes out of Canada, out of a company up there called VoiceAge, and.
Okay.
They have their products in 1.8 billion cell phones, so they got a good track record.
Yeah.
What they have done is worked out a system for compressing voice that's very, very effective, and it's much more effective than MP3 for voice. We can compress this twice as much as we can compress MP3, and still have significantly superior quality, even at twice the compression. So
significantly superior to MP3.
To the MP3, yes.
Wow.
And basically, we did listening tests with this AMR Wideband Plus. It's about I may be wrong a little bit, but approximately right, 30-fold compression. So mm-hmm. you take a an hour-long wave file, you compress it with AMR Wideband Plus, and it's now, you know, it takes up the same space as a two-minute wave file would take up. So it's 1/30th the size. And with the listening tests, we found that it was significantly better than MP3, and for many people, it was almost indistinguishable from the original, you know, CD quality wave file master. Yeah, so it's a great technology, and it'll be good both for keeping the size of the chips down, the flash memory chips, because that's the main cost of the cartridge is going to be in the chips.
Yeah.
And it's also great for download. When we offer books for download, they'll be a small enough size that they'll be able to download in a much faster time than MP3.
And of course, chips are going to continue to come down in price.
They so will. Yeah. And as it's a very good point. I love to lay down the track it's followed. If you took 256 megabytes in 1993, I don't even know what kind of flash memory chips they had then, what size, but it was probably like 100 kilobytes or something like that.
Yeah.
But if you were able to assemble 256 megabytes in 1993, it would have cost you about $25,000.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it costs you about $25 or a little less. And by the time in the next 2-3 years, by the time we get to 2007, 2008, that'll be down, be well under $10. The floor is probably going to be about $4 or $5 for a completed cartridge with all the memory in it and so forth. When we start, it may be, you know, $6 or $7 or $8, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But after a couple of years, we're probably not even going to be able to get 256 megabyte chips. We'll be able to get a 512 or a 1 gigabyte chip for the same amount of money as we were paying for the 200, because the capacities of these chips just keeps growing, and there's a tremendous market for them, and tremendous competition among the big companies who are trying to corner a vast and growing market where they're going to make a lot of money. So we're positioned very nicely. We're sitting on the sidelines watching these guys, you know, out there with their gloves off, duking it out, and the prices just keep coming down and down and down. So it's our strategy looks at this point to be exactly right.
Are you far along with your player that you could talk with us about what it would look like and what the controls would look like? And I have a couple of navigational questions, but first of all, just a general sense of the player itself.
Right, okay. It'll be a tabletop model, and there will be actually two different versions of it, a basic version and an advanced version.
Well, I was going to ask you that, so I'll ask you that later. Just
okay.
Give me the...
Okay, so the dimensions of it, roughly 9 inches deep, mm-hmm. 6 inches wide, and 2 inches high.
So you're going to have enough space for a good larger speaker to get some good sound out of it.
Yeah. So the things that take up the space in the player are working from the front back are the controls, and we've got large controls well spread out, so for older people they're easy to find and easy to manipulate, and with, you know, very different shapes and tactile features and so forth. So controls take up the most of the surface of it, and we deliberately designed it so there's plenty of space for that.
Mm-hmm.
Then you got speaker behind that, and then behind that you have cord storage, and this was a decision that we made that you know, most devices these days have separate cords,
mm-hmm.
and so you can make the device smaller, but then you have to carry the cord around separate.
Yeah, yeah.
And because we're a lending library, we loan the machines, for simplicity's sake, we said, let's build it in as a single unit, the cord's part of it, and then you need the cord storage. So that does increase the size of the machine a bit, a couple of inches in terms of depth, but it means that people don't have to worry about keeping track of separate things and losing them.
Can you give us a sense, if you have it, of what the controls would look like and what they are?
Yeah, and I'll be somewhat general here. I don't want to get too much. But on the basic player, it's you know, not much different than what you have on the C1.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got ability to play, play stop. You got fast forward and rewind, and then you got volume, tone, and speed control. And
that is exactly how Side One ended. Now we'll continue with the interview with Michael Moody from NLS from Playback Magazine on Side Two of the tape.
It's Playback 160, track number two, continuing with the interview with Michael Moody.
Then we go to basically beta testing. And in beta testing, we build build units using the actual materials that will be made, used in the final machine, except they're hand-assembled instead of being done on a production line. So, and then there'll be field tests with the beta tests. So, bottom line, we're looking at late spring of next year to have what we call a final technical data package. That's all the specifications and drawings and everything that is needed for a contract manufacturer to build the machine.
Mm-hmm.
We are doing a multi-phase procurement process so that we can do all of long-term stuff, the stuff that takes a lot of time before the final technical data package is ready. Then once we got that package ready, we will have a very short turnaround time to get the final prices from the vendors, make the award, and get into production as quick as possible. Now, having said get into production as quickly as possible, with a machine like this, you don't just make an award and then a month later they start coming off the production line. It takes... we're looking at probably 9, 10, 11 months or something like that from the time when you make the award to get the production line fully developed, validated, tested, produce machines, test the machines, modified and so forth. So we're looking at early 2008 before the production line is really humming and the stuff is flying off the line.
We got away from your advanced machine.
Right.
Can you give us any sense, even in a general sense, of some of the differences? Is it going to be about the same size?
No, exactly the same size. What our strategy has been is that as much as possible, the two machines share all parts in common except the top cover.
Mm-hmm.
So the base of the machine, the cartridge insertion port, the handle, the cord storage, the printed circuit board inside, the speaker, the battery, all that's the same. All you do is you put a different cover plate on at the factory if you want an advanced as opposed to a basic.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the advanced has then is features that really take advantage of the digital talking book technology. So it allows, you asked about skimming before, it allows you to do navigation through the book in a way that, any of the digital talking book players out there on the market there have these capabilities, which allows you to say, okay, I want to navigate through this book at the chapter level. And so you go next, 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 and it goes chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, inside chapter 5, I know that there are sections. So I want to drop down to the section level, and so you can change to the section level, and now you can go next, next, next. So it's chapter 5, section 5.1, 5.2, 5.3.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, inside section 5.3, I know that there are, let's say, there are journal entries or something like that. Mm-hmm. So you can drop to another level down and, for very fine navigation. Or take a cookbook. You could navigate by chapter, then by recipe, and then inside the recipe, you could go item by item through the list of ingredients. And if you miss something, instead of doing the rewind and guessing where you might be going, you could just press the previous key, and you jump back to the previous item in the recipe list. So very fine control of navigation. You don't have to use it if you don't want. If you just want to play the book beginning to end, you can do that. But if you have a book where you do want this control, you've got it. And you also have bookmark capabilities on the advanced player so that you can lay a bookmark down anywhere and then come back to it later. And let's see, the... Oh, I didn't mention page navigation, but we don't do many books with pages, but the books we do, you need them, and that's why we put them in.
Right.
So if you want to be able, you know, go to page 81, you can do that, or just say jump forward three pages or back three pages, you can do that. So
now, how will you decide who gets what? Is it a matter of the patron requesting which one they want?
Well, it's going to be a process of librarian and patron
together
making that decision. There'll be different issues for current versus new patrons. New patrons on the application will specify, yes, I do want these kind of capabilities, or no, all I want to do is just listen to the book. So we send them a basic player. We assume that the great majority of the players out there will be basic players, but we'll make enough that we'll watch and see, and it's very easy at the production facilities to switch and make a batch of advanced players this week to bump up your quantities. And for existing patrons, it'll be a matter of the library, sending them the player based on what they know about them, or some libraries will probably, check with the patrons before they send it. So,
Now let me get my questions here. I'm getting close to the end, so you can go home for supper.
Okay.
They wanted me to ask you about how extensively NLS plans to support the cassette once this comes out. In other words, how long are you going to stay with books on cassette?
On cassette. Good question. In our planning, we've been looking at supporting the machines out to 2014. So that's probably plenty for most people.
Yeah, that's pretty long time.
Anyway, it's the kind of thing where you can't know for sure, but we know this, that there's lots and lots of copies of cassettes out there. There are a lot of people who will not want to change. We know that there are some people still reading records that have never changed to cassette, and there will be some people, even though the DTB, a digital logbook, will be easier to use, there still will be people who say, I know cassette, I like it, I know how to use it, thanks, I'll just stick with it. And so we'll continue to make books on cassette for probably 3 years of the 4-year transition, something like that, and at that point we'll probably stop. And then if a person wants to use it, they would continue to draw on the existing collection.
Right.
And then magazines, as I said, will continue to be on cassette for a while, and TVT, so people would need to support them for that. So we're fully committed to keeping the cassette machine inventory up, available, and in operation for a good many years.
Well, now, you guys are obviously taking a look at all the stuff that's been recorded, all these readers who people have loved over the years.
Yeah.
What are you doing about thinking about archiving analog stuff?
Well, we have a temperature-controlled archive downstairs, and we've been drawing on that for the conversion of analog to digital, and we'll have about 10,000 older titles and 10,000 newer titles by the 2008 launch. Mm-hmm. And actually the older ones are coming through quite well. We're not finding that many that are too poor quality to convert, but we do know that there are a lot of books in the collection that really there's no need to convert them. Books on diabetes from the 1980s or something. So much has changed that we wouldn't want to do that.
Well, how extensive do you keep the masters?
Oh, we got everything. Everything on cassette, and this goes back to the mid-70s. We've got all those masters down there, and don't have access to many masters I don't think we have any masters to the records before. Mm-hmm. Before the 70s, although we have records, and maybe there has been some talk about getting, using some modern technology to go back. Yeah, that NLS did a project called a Treasury of Talking Books, where they took snippets of different talking books where they read by famous people, and they cleaned those up. So that's an indication of what we can do, and probably in the future we'll go back and look at some older ones there. But basically, we're selecting about 1,500 older titles every year through this transition period, and converting those to digital. So there'll be a good selection of the older ones available. And we'll continue afterwards, but we'll probably never convert all. It'll probably be 65,000 books by the time.
That would be a big job.
Yeah.
Be a big job.
Yeah.
Now, that little snippets thing you were talking about, I believe it's available on a free cassette if people want to listen to it. Is that
yes,
it?
Yes. And I think the regional libraries can loan that to them.
Right. Yeah. Now, we keep hearing about patrons at regional libraries that are being used to help you look at these machines. How do you choose who gets to help you?
Basically, we've been just moving around the country and to different regional libraries trying to have geographic distribution. And then each regional library is responsible for selecting the patrons mm-hmm. that meet our criteria. We say, okay, in this round, we wanted mostly advanced users because we were testing mostly advanced features. And so two-thirds advanced, one-third basic. In the earlier rounds, it was the other way around because most of our users are going to be basic users. So it's up to the library to select the individuals, and we just select the library based, as I said, on geographic distribution. And
now, is some of the stuff they're looking at and responding to a bit sensitive, and you would want them to only report back to you with it?
Well, I mean, these tests are done on a one-on-one basis with mm-hmm. with professional people who do this for a living. Run tests like this, and so they gather the data right there from the patron, usually in the library setting. They also go to some retirement homes, nursing homes, and so forth to test things with older people in those settings too.
But you don't do much of just sending one to somebody's house.
We have not done that yet. We will do that once we get to the beta test, and possibly even with some of the functional prototypes. That's an important thing, is to get it in people's hands in their home setting and let them have it, because a 1 hour, 2 hour test reveals some things, but not others that you only find out are annoying if you've had it for a week. So.
Well, I'm sure you're smart enough to know what my follow-up question is. What would it take to get one of our major reviewers on Playback to get into that list of people who get to look at it?
I think that we might be able to arrange something like that, but I'd have to run it by the powers that be.
Well, would you do that for us?
Yeah, okay.
I have one final question. Tutorials, they're going to be very important to be sure that people know how to use these machines. Are you going to do any field testing on those and get feedback on clarity, or have you got that far yet?
I'm sorry, I was writing down this thing.
Okay.
About the audio, or?
About how the system works. Tutorials
on the
machines.
Yes. And the tutorials will mostly be actually aimed at the libraries, because they're the people who are going to be answering questions. So they'll be probably DVDs with training scenarios to show them, you know, what to do and what the patron should experience and so forth. For the patron, what they will receive at home is a quick start guide in large print and braille, just with about four or five quick things, mm-hmm. And then a getting started, more detail in a couple pages. And then there'll be an audio user guide built into the player that they can access.
I thought there might be.
Yeah. And then there's also the key describer mode, which is very nice. If you don't have a cartridge plugged into the to the player, or then there's other ways to implement it too, then every time you press a button, it'll speak its name, and and not just its name, but what its function is, describe what it does. So that's a really easy way to learn the player.
Michael, this has been a wonderful interview. Can you think of areas that you'd like to bring up and hit upon that I haven't mentioned?
I don't think so. We're still working on the mailing container. We have to design a completely new mailing container, and that's coming along well. And we've working on duplication equipment to make this all happen at the right time. The distribution system I talked about earlier, the mass duplication is one way that's the way we'll start. But after a few years, we'll probably get into a bit of duplication on demand for less popular titles, where it doesn't, you might have a book by a Nobel Prize economist, which is you know, you really needs to be in the collection but isn't going to be read by tons of people.
Yeah.
Well, rather than make hundreds of copies and put them on library shelves all around the country, maybe you just keep that on a server and you make a copy when somebody orders it. So we'll be doing some of that.
Whoa, the band almost trampled Michael there. Well, due to the miracle of the shutoff switch, it's now Thursday morning, and I have about 6 minutes to fill before we have our last features, which are the interview about the Milestone 311 handheld from Independent Living Aids. Then Tim Hendel, and then Roger Smith is having a few little things to say about a device he bought. And the other day, I got a tape from Roger Smith, and he produces a little magazine, not so little, called Listener's Choice. It's all about country music, and I believe Roger probably knows more about country music than anybody I know. And I put it on while I was working out here, and I was really impressed by the tone and the content. He lets people ask for their favorites, and he plays them for them with just enough background to tell you something you probably didn't know. The quality is pristine. Now, I believe you're thinking I'm going to now tell you how much it costs, and I am, because it's absolutely free. Roger provides the tape, he provides the mailer, and to get on the list, all you have to do is to call 502-721-7634 and just leave your name and address. You'll probably get the voicemail, and he'll put you on. Or you can, if you want to, you can email him at snakeguy, one word, at bellsouth.net. It's a very good effort, Roger, and it's a generous thing you're doing for all of us country music lovers. A recent Popular Mechanics briefly described a device they call the Audio Spotlight. It's a 1/2-inch thin disc-shaped speaker that uses ultrasound to deliver audible sound waves within a very focused beam. It's already in use in libraries, some places, and museums, and some retailers around the world. If I can turn a page without hitting the mic. Anyway, it's made by a company called Holosonics, H-O-L-O-S-O-N-I-C-S. The company that makes it plans to release later this year a less expensive, similar item for the home. The home version would allow, say, a listener to a football game to listen to the sound at full volume without disturbing his neighbor or spouse who's reading next to him on the couch. Sounds hard to believe, but don't throw away your headphones yet. We'll keep checking on it for you. Companies such as APH are very dependent upon winning contracts for books and magazines from NLS. They place bids, and so do other companies now. They have a lot of competition. And unfortunately, this year, APH lost a lot to the other bidders. So many magazines they hope to be producing will be produced by their competitors. Now, this serious loss has resulted in several layoffs of personnel, some of which will be some of their readers. I don't have a lot of information on the subject at this time, but I've set up an interview with Gary Mudd, who's vice president in charge of public information, and we'll include it somewhere, playback or the underground. I'm not quite sure. If by Phone is a new interactive phone service trying to get started, and you can call them if you want to and find out about it, 877-295-5100. You can navigate through a rather extensive demo of what they have, but you'll ultimately have to pay some bucks to sign up for specific features. I accessed the chat section and heard some questions from playback member Scott Marshall, who's apparently joined it. And the synthetic speech is really pretty good, although I was amused when I was told to be prescient. I don't think that's prescient, but prescient. Well, maybe this was recorded in China. I don't know. We won't put any of the demos here since you can go on the system and hear them yourself. And there's another 411 free. 411 Metro is yet another free directory assistant service. Who's trying to make a buck by inserting short ads. I don't know if they'll make it, but it's there for us to use now. It works pretty much like the free 411, and I don't know whether this is always the case, but They didn't give me the number automatically that I asked for. They did try to put me in touch with a person who could do that. But you can call them at 800-411-6387, which is Metro. It's good to see these free directory services coming about, and let's hope some of them indeed do last for a while. If you don't like bidding on eBay, well, maybe you'd rather swap. Websites are beginning to emerge that bring swappers together. And one of these, sent along by Playback member Don Hilkema, is SwapThing, SwapThing.com. And a lot of the swapping that happens, he says, in this one is electronics. Punch it up and see what you can find. A lot of you have been looking for some of the old vintage cassette recorders that function better than the new ones. You might give them a try. If your DVD collection is collecting dust, swap it. Swap it for ones you want to listen to, for the ones you're tired of listening to. You can do it for a 99 cents charge with other movie buffs around the country. Simply go to PeerFlix, PeerFlix.com for details. The Milestone 311 voice recorder and MP3 player is a credit card size gadget that is totally accessible to us blind folks, and that is very good news. Not only can you make voice recordings and play MP3 files, but you can also download podcasts, and you can transfer files with the provided USB cable, and you can label the folders in the unit with your own voice. Then you can easily play, delete, and manage files on the unit. It comes with rechargeable batteries. It also comes with an AC adapter, cloth neck strap, and it has a little built-in internal speaker. Now, you can record on the internal microphone, but it also has a jack for external microphone and, of course, a phone jack as well. There are only 6 keys for complete navigation. Now, recordings are saved in MP3 format, and a clear female voice gives you complete feedback as you maneuver around the unit. It has an internal memory of 256 megs, a little skimpy, we think, which translates to 2 hours of recording time. Now, you can expand this with a 2 gigabyte card if you want to, and those are available on the open market. The vendor does not sell those. This would give you 140 hours of recording time. You can contact Independent Living Aids if you want to at 800-537-2118. A fellow named Stephen Guerra, G-U-E-R-R-A, is assistive technology specialist. I called up and talked with Stephen to get more information about it and to try to share his comments with you. He was happy for me to do this. I think such a device is a neat thing to offer. I'm somewhat disappointed about the skimpy built-in memory, which Steve and I will talk about. And I am disappointed about the high shipping charges, which seems to be standard practice for most of these vendors. You'll hear Steve's explanation, which is not satisfactory to me, and I'll have more comments about that after our talk. My first question to Steve, of course, was how much did the Milestone 311 cost?
The pricing for it is $369 plus shipping of $16.95 within the continental United States.
Oh, it costs $16.95 to ship it?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that expensive to ship it?
We're shipping it via UPS Ground, and any amount over $200, if you're familiar with UPS Ground, is $16.95.
Any amount over $200, you mean to insure it?
Well, that's insurance, and that's just part of the ground shipping for any amount over $200.
Well, we send out every day, and we don't pay that kind of bucks. But I won't argue with you about that. You have a 2-gig card that can go along with it.
We actually are not selling the 2-gig or any memory card with it.
Do they take...
Simply because the memory cards used with the unit, suggested memory cards used with the unit, are either the SanDisk or Toshiba brand cards. And since they can be commercially bought at a cheaper price than what ILA can provide, we opted not to sell those cards, but it'd be easier for the individual to...
I understand. I do understand. Who makes this, Steve?
I'm not able to disclose that. It's a manufacturer in Switzerland.
So I'm not so much interested in the company. I guess I was just interested in where. In Switzerland?
In Switzerland.
So you aren't able to tell me what company does this in Switzerland?
No, because we're exclusive rights holders of the unit right now.
The only other thing I want to ask you, and this is purely tentative, it was Independent Living Aids in a position to lend us one of those units for one of our reviewers to take some hands-on experience with.
I can't answer that just yet. I would have to. We would have to. We're waiting for our next shipment to come in first and foremost.
So you don't have them in stock?
We don't have them currently in stock. We sold out of our first 10 within maybe 4 days.
Why do you think they put such a little amount of built-in memory into the system?
Of 2 hours of recording time?
Yeah, that's not much.
Well, it's not much, but it's a standard size. It's a according to what the manufacturer indicated to me. It's not the. They're going, Ed, specifically on testing on the 7.5 million people that they have within this country of Switzerland, that they, even a small percentage of individuals who can't see. They went on that marketing alone, and then they started stretching out to other European countries. So their marketing base is really not as big as what it would be if it was within the United States.
Yeah.
And when you're generally testing things from on overseas, as opposed to testing them here in the United States, they don't have such a market share as they would here. So it's
Which means what?
Well, to me, it means at some point that they felt that the people wanted a small, compact digital recorder, an MP3 player that they can bring with them, and the unit was then made available. Its original unit, the Milestone 310, did not have the memory card. It just had the 2 hours recording time. When they made the Milestone 311 and went into research and development, they inquired about putting in a memory card, and with that, it made the product more attractive to the consumer.
The only point I'm making is that, you know, it costs, and we expect to pay a double or triple for adapted things for blind folks, but I'm looking here at the iPod Nano.
Right.
Which for $199 you can get a 2 gig unit. I mean, we're talking about $380 some for a some kind of meg unit. I don't have the figure here, but
it's 256 meg.
Yeah. So you know, you're talking about about almost 1/10 of the memory.
Yeah, but
twice
we also
the price.
But we also can. I mean, with that, with the iPod Nano or the iPod Shuffle, either one of those two items, and they both shouldn't really be compared, but. In my experience as assistive technology specialist here for ILA, as well as just in my 30 years of experience with assistive technology, the iPod Nano is not going to give you verbal response as the Milestone is.
We understand that. We understand that fully.
And the iPod Nano, I think, overall in comparing it to this unit, really can't, because, again, the iPod Nano just recently, with the use of Rockbox, has made its availability with voice to come out. And again, it's still in an R&D stage.
Yeah.
The Milestone has been tested thoroughly, and it's has a built-in speaker, has a clear female voice, and it has options. And nothing with regard to assistive technology has ever been on the cheap side. We all wish it would be, but it's not.
We understand all that, but the point I'm trying to make is that to have a larger memory base would not be much more space. Wouldn't take up much more space than the one you have. I mean, you know, the larger the memory card doesn't mean that it's going to be larger in size.
I probably agree with you in 100%, and I can say this to you that, you know, with this type of situation, with this being available now in the U.S. market, there's going to be much more ridicule and much more criticism of the unit on a whole. So it might cause the manufacturer to sit back and review as to what it needs to do for its future units.
Well, I wasn't really ridiculing it. I think it's a good thing that it's there. I'm simply trying to explore some questions that came from my readers when they heard about it and sent me some information about it.
Well, Ed, let me say this to you, and you can put this into your article if you wish. There is an email list that I have started via Freelist that subscribers can subscribe to it by emailing milestone311-subscribe@freelist.org.
Is that free list?
Right, freelist.org. Right, .org.
Now, what will that email?
Well, that's generally a place where people can share questions about the Milestone, where I am the moderator of that. I had started that on the question to the manufacturer if they would mind if we started that. They said no, and it's right now I think it holds about a dozen users right now.
Okay.
I think primarily the people who have it.
Yeah.
But as we have more units available and have those readily available, more people will start joining the list. And again, it will be an open forum, discussion forum, with regard to what's the questions about the Milestone and what can it be done to improve it.
Right.
The company that makes Milestone 311 is not so much inclined right now to change the hardware, since they just went through a change. But in their research and development for the future, they might be inclined with comments and criticism from list members because the manufacturer from Milestone for the Milestone 311 is part of the list. He might be inclined after reading those messages that, hey, maybe we need to go back to the drawing board and make this a gig or 2 gig unit as an internal memory.
Well, it looks to me like that would be a fairly simple choice to make. I mean, memory is very cheap these days.
Rightfully so, and you make a valid point. Yeah. However, I'm not an engineer in any stretch of the imagination.
Well, I don't want you to feel that I was calling to challenge the idea of it.
Not at all.
But these are questions that we all need to look at.
Absolutely, and by any chance, by any means, at some point, if your listeners want to contact me, they can contact me by emailing can-do@independentliving.com.
Thanks a lot, Steve. We appreciate your comments. And two things in conclusion. I can't understand why vendors are often so secretive about who makes the items they sell. If ILA has exclusive distributorship anyway, why is it so vital to keep the manufacturer's name secret? They wouldn't sell to us anyway, right? One of the most frequent complaints you lodge with me is the excessive shipping charges from many of these vendors. Now, Steve's comments about that, I simply don't understand. I don't know of any shipper who makes its price on a dollar value. They only count the weight. So let's say what Steve was really talking about was insurance. We went to our UPS book and looked it up and found that you can insure $400 value for an additional $2 cost to the shipping. Now, since the Milestone 311 is credit card size, I really can't believe that it could come anywhere close to weighing a pound, even with elaborate packing. So why $16.95 shipping? The answer I'm suggesting is because they can. Now, I want to be fair with ILA, so if any of you, or if ILA, if they hear this, has any additional insights about why the charge is as it is that I'm missing, I'd really like to know about it, and I'll be glad to include the information next time as a clarification.
This is Tim Hendel with a mini concerning the two cordless phones I reviewed in playback last time, the Panasonic 2326 and the VTech 5857. I have had two people ask me, do these cordless phone handsets feature a headphone microphone jack? Yes, they do. I don't know if it's the standard jack for a headphone microphone thing that you can buy for a cordless phone, or whether either of these is a proprietary, that is to say, unique jack, but they both do have jacks, and I have not tested them. I made some reference last time to the fact that the batteries on the VTech phone didn't last very long. It takes two AA batteries rather than a battery pack. Most of the battery packs that I've seen for cordless phones have three or four cells. This takes two genuine AA batteries. The phone came with two nickel metal hydride batteries, which didn't seem to last long at all. I took the phone back to Radio Shack and got a new one, thinking that maybe there was a short in the handset or something. It came with batteries, which also didn't seem to last. I took the batteries back to Radio Shack, and they ordered me a brand new set of nickel metal hydride batteries. These batteries also don't last very long. I haven't timed them, but they don't last as long as you might expect from a cordless phone. And at some point in their cycle, the speakerphone on the handset does stop working, but the ear listening part will let work for maybe another half hour or an hour. I'm not sure. Since they are AA batteries, you can put two alkaline AA batteries into the phone and it will work. Just be sure not to place it on the charger when you have the alkaline batteries in the phone. The instruction manual warns you in very stern language not to use alkaline batteries, but I'm sure they're thinking of people trying to charge those alkaline batteries. If handset battery life is important to you, the VTEC 5857 is not the phone for you. But if a very loud speaker phone is important, that's the phone you might want to get. If talking handset is important, you might want the Panasonic 2326.
Yes, this is Dick Gary. Anyway, I ran into something that I thought that some of the listeners to playback might be interested in. Apparently, HumanWare has two different toll-free numbers. And you might want to know what they both are. I don't know what the differences are in terms of when you call them. I just happen to run into it. The more familiar one is 800-722-3393. The not-so-familiar one is 888-204-7921.
Well, hello there, playback members. I'm here to give a very brief report on one of our Christmas presents from this year. This is a Dymo label writer. This has nothing to do with Braille Dymo tape. This is made by the Dymo company, and it is a print labeler for labeling addresses and free matter stickers and that sort of thing. This is the model number Duo 93105. And that Duo is in there because it is a dual machine. In the top part of the machine, you can put a roll of large labels for addresses, as well as the return address. You can get the address and the return address and everything on the big label. Near the bottom of the machine, there's a cartridge that contains tape, fairly narrow tape, and that is good for such things as free matter stickers. This printer plugs into a USB port in your computer and is controlled by the computer. And the reason I'm reporting on it in the first place is because of its accessibility. Now, you may need a sighted person to help you set up this printer and its software within your computer to get it all set up to begin with. Once you do that, and once you put your addresses, names and addresses, in the printer's software, in the computer, folks, it is as simple as bringing up the Dymo labeler, finding the correct address, and when you bring it up, it automatically takes you into an extended select box where the addresses are. You can hit the first letter of the name and arrow down from there until you get to the right address. Get to the right address, hit, or the right name. You won't even see the address unless you go into an edit box. But get to the right name, hit Control-P, and voila, a label sticks its head out and can be torn off, and you have that person's address, the return address, the whole bit ready to go. This device is the best thing I have seen for independence in terms of writing addresses and that sort of thing since the good old-fashioned typewriter. It is really, really fantastic and very easy to use. This particular model, I paid $200 for. I think I got it at Staples. You can get them cheaper. In fact, you can get them about half that cheap if you only want one roll, the larger roll of labels for the addresses. If you don't care anything about the tape that does the free matter stickers and that sort of thing. Now, obviously, as far as the other printers are concerned, they're not Dymo. They're made by other, most of the big printer manufacturers make one. Brother makes one, and most of them do. I obviously cannot talk about their software accessibility as I can on this one, but they certainly can be obtained cheaper than we got this one. It, as I say, was about $200. If you have any questions, email me at snakeguy@bellsouth.net, and everybody have a good year. Reporting for Playback, this is Roger Smith in Louisville.
Well, thanks a lot, everybody, for your good stuff, and we hope we'll have a bit more of it next time to keep us from screeching to a halt. It's time now for Playback Classified. Classifieds are free to members. We know that you'll want to keep them accurate, and remember, people are looking for a deal. A member has moved to South Carolina, Greenville, in an area with no sidewalks, no landmarks, and she's frustrated as she can be, and she's wondering if you know about a transponder-type device which could be parked where she needs it to be, and then she could activate a beep from some handheld device. And if you can help her, you can call in afternoons at 864-255-5195. Okay, or you can email Sylvia Sammons, that's her name, small letters, SylviaSammons, at earthlink.net. And then we have a member who's looking to buy a DeckTalk Express external speech synthesizer. It's got to be in good condition. Call Tom Watkin at 630-896-5425. Here's Tom Galante.
I have several Radio Shack shortwave radios that are brand new in the box. They are were closed out by Radio Shack, and I would be happy to discuss those with anyone if people want to call me, which I'll give my phone number at the end here. I also have a Sony 7600GR. This is the digital AM/FM shortwave radio from Sony. It receives single sideband very well. I have that, and I would be willing to sell that for $100. And I also have several tape recorders that I would like to sell, including a couple of handy cassette twos and a Sony Pressman. So if people would like to call me, they can call me in the evening at area code 412-341-6504, or you can email me at tgalante, G-A-L-A-N-T-E, at melon.com.
Hi, Ed. This is Jackie McCraw from Seattle, Washington. I have an ad for your classified. It's a Honeywell thermostat. It's a not for a programmable type of cooling and heating unit. It's both cooling and heating thermostat. It's got raised numbers around the outside edge, about 6 inches in diameter. It's round in shape. I'm selling it for $50, or best offer, and it was originally $130. It's never been used. It's still in the box. So my number is 206-367-8200, or email is xercon, as in Nancy, at msn.com.
And there you have it, another Playback 160 for March 2006, and we made it. So if you don't stay for our abbreviated Potter's Hustles, think about what you can phone in or send in for a mini or an extended report or just information. It sort of is our lifeblood around here. Our Potter's Hustles is very abbreviated this time, and we plan to sort of scale back on it in a general sense. We sell so much through our voicemails, and we'll remind you of some of those and occasionally some bargains, but our main aim in Playback is really information and reports. If you want to hear what's going on with specials and clearances, we have our whole clearance bulletin posted on 2 Fillmore boxes. If you have all-you-can-eat long distance, you might want to go navigate through it, and you can skim it. It's 773-572, as they all begin, 6328 and 6329. Our announcements box is 206-888-5880. We update it Monday and Thursday. Usually we're updating it just Mondays right now, and we'll be back to a more main schedule once new stuff starts coming in. We've been wondering if we ought to be trying to sell DVDs. We're seeing a lot in clearances, and we bought 3 sets to try out, and we don't have all the titles now, but if you're interested, let me quickly tell you about them. We have a 2-DVD set of John Wayne movies, and it's $5.95. We have a 2-DV set of what they call Rat Pack movies. There are two with Frank Sinatra, one with Dean Martin and somebody else, I think Peter Lawford, right, and another one, and Sammy Davis Jr. Then we have a 24 classic movie set of 12 DVDs. Incidentally, the Rat Pack is also $5.95. The 24 classic movies on 12 DVDs is $21. If you want further information, just give me a call. I'll have them sometime later this week, and I can give you more specific titles as we need to. And this is about it for this time. This is Ed Potter at Playback, 1308 Evergreen Avenue, Goldsboro, North Carolina, 27530. Telephone 919-736-0939, and we'll see you again in May.
And that does conclude the complete edition of Playback Magazine for March 2006. For Blind Cool Tech, along with Ed Potter, I'm Steve Bauer.